So welcome to the session on wise action. Is this volume okay, or should I get the microphone? Okay, everyone can hear okay. Okay, let us know if you can't for some reason. And today we're moving into the heart of the ethics section of the path, which is wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. So we'll have yet another session on it. But these action, I mean, it's such a general word, right? When are we not doing some kind of action, which is defined as an act of body, speech, or mind? So this is, excuse me, a very pervasive part of our life, is to be doing things. And so the question is, how can we be putting forth an action that is going to lead away from suffering and not towards suffering for ourselves, for others, or for the world in general? And today we'll be exploring this not in a philosophical, lofty, ideological kind of way, but in a very practical way related to our own life, which is the only place that our actions take place. So the invitation, as always, is to be present for what's happening in our life, whether we're meditating or working or talking with someone. It's all part of life. And I don't think we need introductions. You know me as Kim and Dan as co-teacher. So we look forward to touching into this very pervasive and therefore really important and interesting topic.
So we'll begin as usual with a period of meditation. 20 minutes, is that right?
15.
15, okay. So I invite you to sit in a comfortable upright posture. Just perhaps sitting with the eyes closed to minimize distraction. Bringing awareness into the body, the torso supported by the sits bones. It allows us to hold an upright posture without generating a lot of stress in the body. We quite naturally notice that the most obvious thing occurring is the breath. We easily direct our awareness to the movement of the breath at the abdomen or the tip of the nostrils, whichever you prefer. Resting awareness there. With the intention of knowing the breath as clearly as possible. Aware of its beginning and duration, the character of the breath. The action of turning the mind to the object of the breath for the purpose of calming the body and the mind, developing stability. Aware of any resistance the mind may have, and treating it gently, understanding its desire to be entertained and distracted, but nevertheless gently insisting that we return awareness to the breath. having the opportunity to observe right action in a very focused way, having to do only with this next in-breath and out-breath. And our intention to maintain awareness there. stand up and get a little table over here. And while I do that, just as a kind of reminder that when we're in the realm of right action, we're very much completely in the realm of relationships. So if you would turn to the person closest to you and introduce yourself if necessary, and just welcome each other here this afternoon.
My name's Kim, by the way.
I thought I'd see you somewhere. I'm using my tablet. If you remember the last time, my printer didn't work. And so I have my talk on this tablet. And the last time I used it here, I dropped it on the floor. And all of the cracks are clearly visible. So we'll see what happens this time. So as Kim mentioned, as we began and we had our meditation, it's difficult to imagine any time when we are not engaged in some form of activity. Sometimes our field of practice is wisely contained. We sit on the cushion. We fashion a world from the material of our body and our breath so that we may see as clearly as possible how the mind works. In this field, in this pasture, the subtle movement of attraction and aversion can be felt. And the inclination of the mind informs us what is to come, the arising of sense desire or ill will. In addition, we might notice the predisposition of the mind. Is the mind fearful or angry, anxious? Is it at ease and content, happy? With that knowledge, we know the possibility of freedom is also at hand. Ill will, sense desire, can be set aside. The mind-heart can rest unentangled and at peace, seeing and knowing impermanence, learning to let go. When we leave the safety of this pasture and move into the open, the material for continued practice is still whatever arises. But now we are in the field, the pasture of karma. What arises now requires action. Perhaps we remember the words from the daily recollections. We are born of our actions. Supported by our actions are the air of our actions. All that we do, for good or for ill, of that we are the air. This is all that we can truly call our own. This can be an unsettling experience. But the Buddha, the good doctor, has not abandoned us here. We continue to follow the prescription offered to us in the Eightfold Path. View and intention continue to clarify the way we move forward. This is important to keep in mind since we are asked to move forward toward experience, not away. This became quite clear when we engaged this past month with right speech. The most challenging, the gnarliest, the most constantly encountered of all the precepts. From our practice with right speech, we learn the importance of behavior that is appropriate. The elements of timeliness, beneficence, honesty, and truth will continue to be important as we continue on to the work in this field of right action. The suttas say, and what, monks, is right action? Refraining from taking life. Refraining from taking what is not given. Refraining from sexual misconduct. We can safely say that ahimsa, non-harming, is the core of all the precepts. The guidance we find here is applicable to all of our actions. Of the first precept, the Buddha says, here, someone avoids the taking of life and abstains from it. Without stick or sword, conscientious, full of sympathy, he is desirous of the welfare of all beings. I was really struck by this very short description of non-harming and spent a lot of time kind of mulling over just about each word in this description. First of all, without a stick or a sword. The notion that we might come to our experience, the experience of whatever arises, completely unarmed, not defensive, not defended by our opinions, not holding to fixed views. I think for most of us, we bring a lot to each experience. We bring a very well-crafted self, a self that is complete with various forms of armor, made from various materials and presented in our own special way to let people know that there are some boundaries that cannot be crossed. There are some opinions, some thoughts that I view as truth, and you must not differ from me. We also meet our experience conscientiously. The dictionary says that conscientious means governed by conscience, controlled by or done according to one's inner sense of what is right, principled, careful and painstaking, meticulous and scrupulous. How do we gain this experience, this conscience? So here also, the Buddha is very clear. He tells us in the passage from the Kalama Sutta that you're probably very familiar with, that speaking to the monks, he says, when you know for yourselves these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should live in accordance with them. This view of how conscience is developed is quite a bit different than the conscience that perhaps we developed from our childhood, from our experience with our parents and schools and perhaps religious teachers, that conscience was developed by someone else telling you what was right and wrong and then you doing that. Buddha is much more subtle and comprehensive in his understanding of how conscience is formed and how it can be employed in the most useful way. And he tells us that there is this feedback loop that gets created every time we interact with any experience in our lives, and that the instruction is to learn from all of those actions, so that we in our own experience can discern what is right and appropriate. We can't fall back on some dictum that's been presented to us and that perhaps we've even come to cherish but not examined to see whether it truly is appropriate in every situation. The Buddha also says that right, that not harming, must be full of sympathy. The sympathy comes from an understanding developed from observation and from listening, from being truly present for whatever experience, whatever phenomena is arising. Here, it's well to remember what we learned from the practice of right speech, what is timely, what is truthful, what is really helpful. And lastly, the Buddha says in this brief description that we should be desirous of the welfare of all sentient beings. Again, reminding us of right intention and the Brahma Viharas. The positive counterpart of not taking life, non-harming, is the development of kindness and compassion for other beings. The second element of right action, that of not taking what is not given, it's easily understood, I think, that it creates real refuge, a real refuge of safety in society and in our interpersonal relationships. We don't have to worry, and those around us don't have to worry, whether we'll be taking their stuff. But this notion of taking stuff, when we think about it, can actually encompass a great deal more of our activity. It's interesting, recently I was thinking about time as an element that we're capable of stealing. Somebody mentioned to me that they had read a passage where someone said, you know, we don't really buy things with money. We buy them with time. Buy them with time. It set me about kind of thinking about how I might be stealing some of that time from what is actually a good and skillful way of going about my day. How I might be stealing time every time I stare at this contraption and find myself trapped in YouTube for several hours. No matter how entertaining or educational I might think it is, I might be stealing time from my family. I might be stealing time from my friends. I might be stealing time from useful work that I'm responsible for doing. The positive expression of this precept is contentment. The Buddha called this our greatest wealth. And this fit really easily into my exploration of time. And particularly when I would find myself on Amazon and able to really feed my discontent with the world, seeing the millions and millions of things that were being offered to make my life happy. This is not a very contented place to be in our lives, offering ourselves up for a really fruitless and a difficult level of suffering as we're in the world consistently allowing ourselves to be available to be convinced that we just don't have enough, our life isn't good enough. So in this time of overconsumption of resources, the expression of non-stealing might mean not taking or using more than we need. It might be worth sitting and asking ourselves, what more do we need to be content? What more do we really need to be content? Which might lead to the question of, what more can I let go of and still be content? So the next precept included under right action is that of avoiding sexual misconduct. Early on in my practice, Upandita was a teacher that was often quoted, particularly when on retreats. And I will never forget this one quote from Upandita. He says, "Lust cracks the brain." Lust cracks the brain. Yes, I think we have plenty of evidence over the last few weeks in our world that this is true. We have been reading about and hearing about a lot of people whose brains have clearly been cracked. And the consequences of some of that brain cracking has been pretty severe. You know, whole lives disrupted. So this notion of the misuse of our sexuality or the proper use of sexuality, I think can, given our experience of the past couple of weeks, can maybe most appropriately be widened to talk about not only just strictly sexuality, but how we relate to each other based on gender. It could, of course, be even expanded further than that. And sexuality is perhaps the strongest feeling that we have to deal with. We have anger, fear, feelings around sexuality, very, very strong. For that reason, they could be extremely easy to work with and show us a lot about the workings of desire. We usually think that the only choice we have when we're in the throes of strong sexual feelings is that we can express it or suppress it. Suppressing was a favorite tactic when I was in the seminary, and we usually played basketball at those times. We had very good basketball teams. In fact, we won nearly every game that we engaged in with high schools and stuff outside. But we practiced a lot of basketball. With mindful awareness, though, we can actually go beyond these two choices of expressing our sexuality or suppressing it or repressing it. We can learn to feel this force of desire, to open to it, and then see that it arises and it passes away. I like Thich Nhat Hanh's framing of this precept. It very much speaks to the positive side, the proper use of sexuality and our consideration of what is appropriate. His framing of the precept is this: aware of the suffering caused by sexual misconduct, I vow to cultivate responsibility and learn to protect the safety and integrity of individuals, couples, families, and society to preserve the happiness of myself and others. Quite a lot more to consider than simply abstaining from misuse of my sexuality. A very rich area for practice, and one that we should not back away from. It's something that we all encounter in powerful ways. And And in that examination, I think one of the things that becomes apparent is how frequently sexual energy is part of whatever encounter, whatever relationship we're involved in. So we cultivate all of these steps for their ethical value and also as an essential means for awakening. Joseph Goldstein quotes someone as saying, if practicing the precepts doesn't make us uncomfortable, it's a sign that we should investigate further. He says this, when he first heard this, he was very appreciative in that it points to those steps on the path as actual practices, things to understand and investigate in our lives, rather than taking for granted that we're basically good people and then looking no further. I think the difficulty of dealing with the precepts for me, one of the main difficulties is that there's too much. Every time I step into some facet of working with the precepts, the roots of the precepts are entangled in every part of our practice. There is no part of our practice that is not somehow connected to how we act in the world. And our practice is such an obvious and invaluable way of engaging with the world and continually learning how to tune how we are with the world. How we engage with the world, how we bring those elements of practice, the Brahma Viharas, to our daily life, our daily encounters with others and with ourselves. Sometimes we simply consider the precepts to be this sort of a mundane part of our practice. Yeah, here's the commandments. We should do these. If we do these, we'll be good people. But actually, they work at a much, much deeper level than just this level of civility and not harming on a kind of superficial level, actually. If we allow them to work on us, they will work at non-harming on an extremely deep level, which includes not harming ourselves as well as others. And learning not to harm ourselves puts us in a much better position to offer friendliness, compassion to others. So that's what I have for you this afternoon. Are we doing questions now? So I have two questions, and let's see, we have... Looks like, what, 11?
10?
10, 11? Maybe we should just do pairs. Let's do that. So let's just pair up. Right. We'll do that now and then I'll give you the questions. The first question. I'd like you to imagine an instance where you consciously engaged with something that was happening, consciously engaged as a practice. So not afterwards, after something happened, you went backwards and said, oh yeah, I could have done that so much better. But that something occurred and you realized at that moment that this was an opportunity for practice. Or if you sort of set your day in motion that way, that is, if there's something that you do at the beginning of a day that helps you establish this reference that says, my entire day is a day of practice, all my activity. So having done one or the other of those, what methods did you employ? What helped you come to that decision to engage in this activity as practice? Is that understandable? Not a single head is moving. Any questions about that? Okay, so we have, let's say, 3 minutes each. I'll ring the bell for that. Second question, I'm just finding it. So here's the second question. When sexual desire arises, how does the mind relate to it? So I'll just read you a bit of what Joseph Goldstein offers in terms of thinking about this question. Do we indulge the fantasies because they're pleasant, because there's not much sloth and torpor? At these times? Is there fear of this desire or aversion to the idea of it arising and disturbing our practice? Or can we see it with equanimity and wisdom as simply being part of the passing show of phenomena? In meditation, we begin to feel the whole body as an energy field. And this field is felt and expressed in different ways depending on where we focus our attention. So again, the question is, when sexual desire arises, how does the mind relate to it? Yeah. Only 3 minutes, that's it. Seemed like there were some interesting discussions going on, which Kim and I don't really know anything about. So, but you're willing to share some of those discussions, we would really appreciate it.
From either question, of course.
Yeah, for either question. In case you've forgotten the first question. So this had to do with recalling a time or a day where you consciously saw your activity as chose to see your activity as an activity of practice. And were there any sort of tools or methods or ways that you had of making that a conscious reality in your interactions? What were you talking about all that time?
I found that I feel like this is a really hard, this right speech and right action, really, really hard for me to remember there's that space between the an event and my reaction to it, mm-hmm. or my response to it. But I do my meditation every morning, and I make the plan for the day, and I, mm-hmm. you know, and I have the best of intentions, and they sometimes seem to fall by the wayside. But I watch that I set that has a little timer on it that just beeps every hour, just a little beep. Mm-hmm. And I find that if to meditate in the morning and set that plan for 24 hours is a big chunk of time, but at least maybe if my watch beeps, maybe I can keep it in my mind for the next hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes
that helps and sometimes it doesn't. Great, great. Thank you. So the intention setting in the beginning of the day, and also being kind enough to ourselves that to remember that intentions are intentions,
right.
and to hold the precepts as training precepts, right? That this is something that we don't expect to adhere to perfectly in the course of our day, but that we would bring awareness to them. And we would continue working with them. And then the notion of establishing some way of reminding ourselves through the course of the day at different intervals to be present, to bring that mindfulness to our activity. Thank you.
The only problem with that is you get really used to hearing that beep every hour, so sometimes it's like you
hear. Start ignoring it then, you think?
Change the time span.
Yeah.
It was interesting. I was working in the kitchen at IRC, a couple of months ago with Chris Clifford, and no one had ever done this before, but she brought her her phone with her that had the insight timer on it, and she set the insight timer so it went off every half hour. And it would go off in a half hour, and then our agreement was that we would just take a moment of silence. So no matter what you were doing in the kitchen, no matter how crazy your activity was or how relaxed you were, could be either, everyone would just stop for a moment and have a moment of silence. And that completely changed the atmosphere whenever things maybe were getting a little bit tense, or you could feel a deadline coming up or something like that, that you could just go, and this is all fine, this is just fine, you know, and really reestablish your presence and your intention around doing that work in the kitchen for the benefit of people that were on retreat. So. Anyone else? Before we go into question two, that's the more interesting one, don't you think? So that question was, when sexual desire arises, how does the mind relate to it? Maybe they don't have any experience with this, do you think?
Maybe not.
How does the mind relate to it?
Uh-huh.
It could be any of many responses.
Yes.
But the underlying thing that I would say, but we didn't talk about because our conversation went off in a different direction for our monologues, is the mind gets very kind of jumpy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, shouldn't I? Or other questions arise. And I find it pops all over for a little while, like popcorn. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, Dan was saying that it's a very powerful energy, and so it naturally has effects throughout the mind. It's just easy to observe that. Thanks for pointing that out.
I liked, actually, Joseph's comment that when sexual desire was present, sloth and torpor weren't really such a big problem.
Yeah.
I'm
sorry, I couldn't hear that.
But when sexual desire arises, that sloth and torpor are not really a big problem.
Exactly.
I separate in my mind somehow the fantasy thing and the relationship thing, you know, and the fantasy or... That's almost like nervous, restless, you know, distraction, watching television and kind of in that thing. And in the context of a relationship, I think it's, well, usually it's positive. It usually comes with, you know, feelings of love and connection or wanting connection or, the fantasy thing I try to pretty much shut down or notice that it's there and, you know, acknowledge it and go away from it. That's like the distraction and the one of the things that I'd like to sort of grow out of after 70 years.
No. It's actually one of the astounding things to me too is that it just does not go away. You know? It's like, I think throughout my whole life, I thought, well, this is all going to be gone when I'm 60 or something. It's not. I was relating a story to Kim about someone we know mutually who had prostate cancer, and part of the treatment was taking some drugs which diminished testosterone. And his response to that was how freeing it was that he completely had lost all of this, you know, every time he saw a woman that he had to go look and, you know, that kind of, he says, it's just like gone. I didn't have that anymore. I had so much more time, you know, and so much more ease. You know. So, but I frequently meet with some people who are in their 90s who will testify that this is something that we just have to deal with, you know, for all the time. Which is kind of makes it interesting. So you alluded to the fact that when this arises for you, that you just kind of make it go away. You want to suppress it. So then we're on one of those two possible things that could happen. We repress it, suppress it, or we express it in some way. But then the question actually points to the fact of, can we just be with it during the course of its arising and notice that it's just something that's arising and notice undoubtedly all of the effects that will occur during the arising, because as May alluded to, it's a very active kind of energy. So can we, in our practice, be with that energy until it passes away, knowing that it's going to pass away? It will.
I'm remembering something else that Joseph Goldstein shared one time at a retreat. I think it's actually kind of nice that there are teachers who really are willing to talk about this subject, because it tends to get avoided sometimes, and yet it's a large part of human life, right? And he said that when he went through a lot of different stages, he eventually arrived at this one that Dan shared, where he could just see it arise and pass, but he said it took him years to get there. And during the time when he was thinking every time he had a sexual thought, it was like something terrible and non-spiritual, he found the technique that worked for him to be able to stay present was to, he was doing the noting technique, and so he would note, you know, sexual fantasy, and he would note that like once, and then he was in it. You know, it was just, he couldn't, it wasn't a strong enough mindfulness bell for him. So he used what he called a double note, and he said that he would note sexual fantasy, and then he would note pleasant. So he would also note the feeling tone. And when he had those two on there, he was able to stay with it. And he could see that it started usually from an image that just, you know, a random image that came into his mind. It didn't even have to be that he was literally seeing somebody that he was attracted to. And, yeah, so I appreciated that he shared so clearly what it was that he had to do with his mind. So you might give that a try if it's of interest.
Okay, so I think we're going to take a 5-minute break. Do your business. Come on back.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.